Welcome to the April edition of the UCLA Anderson Forecast Direct podcast. And today we are privileged to be talking with Mordecai Kurtz. Mordecai is the Joan Kenney Professor of Economics Emeritus at Stanford University. Professor Kurtz has a distinguished career incorporating and investigating important questions related to economic growth of countries and public economics. Mordecai has done work on neoclassical growth theory, general equilibrium theory, game theory, income distribution, and in addition to a substantial amount of empirical work, he served as the director of economics at the Institute for Mathematical Studies in the Social Sciences, IMSSS, at Stanford University from 1969 to 1989. Mordecai has a new book. It's entitled The Market Power of Technology, Understanding the Second Gilded Age. And it focuses on one of the most important questions today, which is increasing inequality and the implication both for the economy and perhaps more importantly for society at large. One of the things that I really liked about this book is that while tackling these important issues, which requires careful and rigorous analysis, the intuition as to why the analysis makes sense is presented in great detail. And that's kind of unusual for a book which has, such a deep technical background. And so, Mordecai, welcome to UCLA, and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
I'm pleased to be here.
So I think I'd like to start out with a question about how you got to this, because I know in your earlier work, it was really focusing on ferreting out the properties of equilibria. I remember your paper, Optimal Economic Growth with Wealth Effects, and your series on rational beliefs and equilibria. So maybe you can take us through some of the evolution of how you went from that equilibrium theory to what seems to be more of a disequilibrium or a movement to a different kind of equilibrium.
Well, growth theory is really about growth and distribution. But I'm a product of the middle century, in which inequality was pretty much constant. In other words, the distribution was constant because policy was very strongly, not egalitarian, but preserving the status quo in some sense of balance of power between various recipients of income. But the thesis changed. And to me, a very important article appeared in 2003 in a JPE, which is the more important paper of Piketty and Saez. And they succeeded in getting income tax data, something that was not available to anybody before that time. And it was a shocker because it showed a dramatic increase in inequality, which means that all the tenets of most of the work that we have done on neoclassical theory came into question. So that prompted me to go back and ask myself, what have we done wrong? And as I began to dig into the data and began to look at the different models that were used, I realized that I'm coming through with entirely different paradigm. And the paradigm is a paradigm of not a competitive equilibrium, but a paradigm in which balance of power is based on the possibility of business accumulating much more power than we knew during the 20th century. So that led me to this research, which I have now spent on which I have spent since 2010, actually, 14 years. That's pretty much a summary of it.
Yeah, that's really quite interesting. So you compare today to the first Gilded Age, I mean, even right in the title of the book, and the first Gilded Age kind of began at the close of the frontier, and then you have this growth of inequality, and today you have this growth of inequality. What do we learn from that first Gilded Age that's applicable or maybe not applicable to today?
Jerry, one of the great surprises of my work, my research, and the more I research it, the more I'm surprised by that, how similar the two ages are. Both periods had very high rate of innovations, and free and unrestricted free market policy in which there was no limitation on business expansion at that time. And the consequence of the same, rising inequality. And strangely, the people in the 19th century created these enormous trusts, and they believed in power. They worship power and wealth. And the same worship of power and wealth you see today. If you go to Silicon Valley, this is all that they're talking about. How do you get power? How do you get wealth? And you know, if you read many of the things that they write, you can't get wealth without power. You look at democracy, it declined in both periods. In both periods, we find substantial social polarization. In both periods, the Supreme Court objected and resisted reform. In the first Gilded Age, it was the Lochner decision, Lochner versus New York decision of 1905, in which the Supreme Court used a small case of a bakery in New York, and New York passed a law to try to prevent a number of hours per day to exceed 10 hours and 60 hours a week, and the Supreme Court threw it out. And then continued to throw out every legislation until 1937. As you know, this also led to the confrontation with the administration during the New Deal. Then finally, we have in both periods, we have huge waves of mergers and acquisitions. Companies acquired, they became large not only by organic growth, but mostly by acquisitions. And so the similarity is mind-boggling. We're repeating, America is repeating the story of the first Gilded Age.
You know, you spoke of this period of sort of greater equality or less inequality. So the middle to the late 20th century. But during that time, you know, that was a time of innovation, as you said.
Yes.
And we had kind of on the backs of Edward Bassett and Robert Moses, the development of freeways, for example, which fundamentally changed American cities, particularly here in my city in Los Angeles. And then you had companies like GM coming in, innovating with automobiles and really pushing out the public transit monopolies, which were primarily private at that time. Is that something that's sort of really characteristic of the way in which the capitalist system works? I mean, is that what we're seeing today with, for example, tech companies?
Well, I can't say that I know the history of Los Angeles very well, but I think the principle that you're talking about is very clear. What happens here is a situation where General Motors was acquiring essentially a monopoly in that area. And by incorporating the roads and having influence on the roads, they were combining the technology of making cars and the technology of transportation. Now, they didn't own it. They just coordinated between the two. In fact, what happens today, this is a very fundamental point in my theory. And that is, the theory says that market power is permanent, and it's permanent because firms are innovating, but instead of losing that power that comes with innovation, because patents expire and information diffuses, they find ways of reconstituting that power by consolidating, by merging together. So in the case that we see in the analogy that to the automobiles and the road, think about Facebook acquiring all kinds of companies that could have been competitors, or Google acquiring, you know, Google has 250 companies inside of it. Microsoft has 256 companies inside of it. So these are acquisitions which are made in order to consolidate power, which is originally, each one of them was very innovative company to begin with, no question about it. And their innovations are very important for our society. They are essential for economic growth and progress. But they succeed in using that advantage to consolidate power and then maintaining for a very long time. So the case of Los Angeles and General Motors is just a simple example of the same principle.
And I, you know, something you referred to earlier was during that period when General Motors was engaged in this, and we had the freeways system coming into the U.S., kind of similar to the internet coming into the
right. That's
U.S.
exactly
and the world.
Yes.
But during that period, you indicated that policy kept inequality from rising, at least dramatically. And I guess that's the difference between today and then that you're suggesting and that your research uncovers.
That's right. I mean, if you look, essentially, we want innovations. We want companies to have market power when they innovate because their innovations are essential. But we want that market power to dissipate because patents are designed to end. They are designed to give a temporary profits, not permanent. They have succeeded in building it into such a thing that there are many companies in America that are longer, they have enormous market power today, and they are more than 100 years old. So that the answer is yes, it's exactly what I'm talking about. But I'm just repeating myself now.
But let's dig into that a little further.
Yeah.
I
can talk about the opposite, which is the period at which market power was contained and equality was achieved during the period from 1930 to about 1980.
And you know, what was it, that patents were different, the length of patents?
No. The main tools used are tax rates. You know, if you tax companies by 50%, and your marginal income tax on wealthy people is 95%, you take away this money. And that money is essential for the system that you can't acquire if you don't have money to acquire. You can't buy somebody else if you don't have the money to buy somebody else. So if you don't have money, you cannot pay $50 million or $100 million or $47 billion to somebody who's running your company. So first of all, the government was taking away the money. Secondly, we got substantial antitrust, particularly after 1950. And thirdly, in very sustained effort to support workers, unionization. In 1955, 35% of America was unionized. And that presented a balance that helped to create a balance of power in the economy and society. Society was more balanced between the various components. So the New Deal policies were able to achieve a much better equilibrium, social equilibrium, and social balance of power, so that no one was gaining ground over somebody else. That was the mechanism they used. Now, I don't think it's enough. In my book, I'm making proposals to make many other reforms, including the patent law. The patent law is essentially broken. I think that antitrust law is also broken.
Is it that they're broken or they're not enforced? Well, let's patent laws to begin with. How does one decide the optimal length of a patent to induce innovation but not create monopolies?
Well, I think that you're asking a very hard question, and I don't. The truth of the matter is, I don't know the answer. What I do know is one thing: patent pyramids are created by getting one patent, important patent, but then building on top of it a whole pyramid of second patents, third patent, fourth patent that depend upon the original one. But each one of these patents have 20 years life. The principle that I'm proposing is that these secondary patents should be much shorter because they are less important. They don't contribute as much to society. So I don't want to change the first patent. If you made a patent, you got it for 20 years, get yourself monopoly power, make as much profit as you can, but end it. and let's move on. Let somebody else do something else. Don't start taking everything away from us.
Right.
That's the only principle I understand. Okay, I'm not a patent lawyer. I spend a lot of time with patent lawyers trying to come up with an answer, with a good answer to your question, how to change the first patent. But I don't know. Let the lawyers decide. Let society decide what they want. There are lots of patents which are issued about nonsense, and we should stop it.
Mm-hmm. Those derivative patents.
Yes.
And
the patent office should be equipped with much more powerful, much more stronger technical knowledge. They don't have enough staff. They don't have enough scientists to judge what is true innovation and what's nonsense. So that we need to be more disciplined in issuing patents, and we need to shorten the life of secondary patents. That's the two principles that I believe are completely common sense. And most patent lawyers agree with me, but they just don't know how to do it to get it done, you know?
Right. you mentioned early on the paper by Piketty and Science. And of course, Thomas Piketty wrote the very in-depth, voluminous book, Capital in the 21st Century. It seems like in that book, one of the points that he's making, or at least that was one of my takeaways, was that that except for during the interwar period when a lot of physical capital was destroyed, that, you know, what happens is that the, I think what he called the rentier class, but the very wealthy tend to end up owning about 6 to 7 times GDP in wealth. And that's a kind of equilibrium. Is that consistent with the research that you've done, or somewhat different?
It's unfortunately very different. Okay. To really understand the difference between Piketty and I, but me, is Piketty wanted to rewrite Karl Marx theory into neoclassical theory, make it into a rigorous neoclassical theory. But still, the key to his structure is capital and labor. I think this is wrong. I think that fundamentally it is wrong. Marx's theory is wrong in that respect. Marx's theory of capitalism is wrong in this respect. Because the issue for me is monopoly power and monopoly profits. In other words, the recipients of income in my system are three, not two, not only capital and labor. For me, somebody who's a retiree living at Stanford University is a capitalist. Why? Because he uses capital, he lives on capital, and he gets income from capital because he rents this capital to companies who pay him some interest rate. But a technologist in Silicon Valley that invents something and has a monopoly over it and extract high profits from a technology or from a drug for which he charges $50,000, he has a monopoly profit. He generates monopoly profits. Therefore, the income in the economy is divided into three: monopoly profits, capital income, and labor. It's the struggle is not between labor and capital. The struggle is technology and monopolist power extracting income from capital and from labor. Both are exploited by technology. So the struggle is much more complicated, and variations in income distribution, variations in inequality, depends how much monopoly profits there are, and how much exploitation is the technology exploiting labor, not capital and labor. And therefore, this is an entirely different scheme, it's an entirely different structure, it's an entirely different theory. And I don't believe, by the way, I don't believe that Piketty's theory is accepted in the profession, because there are many people who raised many questions about his equation, his relationship between, you know, he has a theory about relationship between the interest rate and the growth rate, as if the interest rate, the key element which is mistaken in his theory, is that he proposes that the interest rate represents the growth rate of capital income. But that's not true, because the growth rate of capital income depends upon how much they save. If capitalists just eat up all their income, they don't save anything and capital doesn't grow at all.
Right.
It's the savings that matters, not the interest rate. So I have some, as you can see, I have substantial objections to this theory.
Yes, and I agree with you that that is not widely accepted amongst the economics profession. But you've brought up a number of times, and you bring up in your book, and I think this is maybe one of the most important contributions of your book for society, is that increased monopolization makes capitalism a threat at times to democracy. And you know, one of the things that we see today is social media creating this polarization and maybe even being anti-democratic. You know, apart from that, what is the threat that you see and the threat that you conclude from your research?
The most important threat that I see is not only the fact that there's a lot of monopoly profits, but also that there is a free market policy in which we are telling people that they need to take care of themselves, that they need to act like Ayn Rand heroes.
Mm-hmm.
The heroes of their life, and their society has got nothing to do with them. The issue is this: when you have technological changes, society changes, and there are always winners and there are always losers. And these losers are losing because it is in a democracy. And these losers, in this case today, in the past 45 years, it has been mostly unskilled laborers, unskilled workers in America. They have been the losers. But at some point, these people ask, we've done nothing wrong. You know, we've spent our time working very hard. We saved as much as we needed. We sent our children to school. We did what America asked us to do. America asked us to do. Why are we being thrown to the dogs? And this becomes a serious problem, because the large number of people that this encompasses causes also a decline of large sections of American society. Rural America, many parts of urban America are in decay because of that. So why are these people suffering? They didn't do anything wrong. So the combination of, so they, at some point they come and say, look, at my expense, these people become billionaires. But this is in democracy, that should not be the case. Democracy should give us equal opportunity. By the way, economists have solved the problem by simply insisting that a good policy and a good economic policy should have the winners compensate the losers. This is called Pareto optimum policy. This is a fundamental textbook concept in economics, but we don't practice that. We let the losers lose and the winners walk away with their profits. So as when you introduce technology and monopoly profits, the power, this, the difference between the losers and the winners becomes so large that it causes social polarization. So it's not only the social media is a very small component of the decline in democracy. To me, the decline of democracy is a direct consequence of society not being able to handle properly this growing tension between the winners and losers in society. And by the way, this is the subject of my next book.
Well, you know, that I certainly look forward to. What about AI? I mean, there's a lot of investment going into AI. The sort of narrative today is that AI is going to fundamentally transform the world we live in. Is this going to have an impact? Is it going to be breaking monopolies? Is it going to further the kind of processes that you describe in your book?
Jerry, I must tell you the answer, the truth I have no idea. That's number one.
Okay.
I'm, on the other hand, very impressed by an article I just read the last week by an MIT economist. His name is David Autor. And David wrote a very interesting paper just, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. What he argues, a very new argument, which really has been, I've been thinking about it a lot. He says, look, AI is not really able to make decisions by itself. At the end, AI is a tool that we use to sort of get a lot of information quickly and assemble it so that one can use it for making decisions. At the end, people have to be involved in some way. Therefore, what he argues, AI, in his opinion, will actually give greater power to unskilled workers. Why? Because an unskilled worker who doesn't have a college degree can use AI to make big decisions by asking the machine how to look at the problem that he doesn't have the education to study and be able to look at it and make a good judgment of how to handle the problem. In other words, this will empower those who don't have power. And in that sense, it will actually act as an equalizer in society. Isn't an interesting argument?
Yeah, and in some sense, you know, when you think about the mechanical revolution, the Industrial Revolution, it augmented physical capabilities.
Exactly like the assembly line. Exactly correct. Yes.
Yeah, and this augments cognitive and educational differences.
Yes. So, I don't know. I mean, this is too early to tell, quite frankly. But I think this type of argument is very interesting, should be considered very carefully. What I am sure of is we must choose what technology to allow, and we must choose what technology not to allow. I think that we need much more public discussion, and I think we need much more public decision and control over what technology we allow to destroy or build our society. I don't think that technological change should just happen out there on its own and let Silicon Valley do whatever they want. I think that we should have much more social discussion about what is appropriate and what's not.
So unfettered capitalism does not have embedded in it the answer that kind of leads us to that period of more equality, as in the second half of the 20th century.
I think that capitalism is one of the greatest invention of humanity. Capitalism is enabling people the freedom to innovate, to create fantastic things and move us forward. But capitalism doesn't have to be completely free and unrestrained. Capitalism has to be an instrument of society. I don't want society to control them, but I want society to create rules by which they will operate, in which the incentives will be preserved and society will benefit from all that's been done.
So let's go back to the First Gilded Age. And the First Gilded Age seemed to have come to a close with certainly, you know, the First World War, but then in the 1920s, the last Roaring Twenties, we had a whipsaw of deep but short recessions, but then followed by the Great Depression and a whole host of reforms in the New Deal. That was what happened in the U.S. In Europe, they didn't have the New Deal, but they had authoritarian governments take over. Are we looking at a situation where there's going to need to be some major events to actually create the kinds of reforms that you discuss in your book? Or what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I have a whole section in my book on that. I don't think you may have not noticed this. And I claim that I claim actually that the Gilded Age began to come to an end again by a completely accidental event called the assassination of McKinley. And then a consequence of that came to power in the White House a person who is a Republican, but a Republican who believed in democracy and believed in progress and was willing to engage in serious changes in America. And his name is Teddy Roosevelt. In 1901, in my opinion, and this, by the way, the statistics shows that much of the statistics of the Gilded Age changes exactly in 1901. Now, it's true that the Gilded Age, technically, historians ended in 1914. But I believe that from the economic point of view, it began to die in 1901 when he decided to go after Ford and after Rockefeller and after the Baron to impose antitrust. And that began a whole series of reforms. 1906, you've got the Food and Drug Administration. 1913, you've got the Federal Reserve. And then comes the introduction, the change of income tax, and many other events, because Taft and Wilson actually continued the reform of Roosevelt. Now, it's true, 1920s was all reforms got stopped when the Republicans took over. Right. But the New Deal ended and consolidated all the reforms that began actually in 1901. Are we going to have an event like that in the future? I don't know. The 2024 elections are perhaps the most important elections in our life, because if Trump is elected, I think that the chance of any reform is dead. If Biden is elected, perhaps we may begin, because some of his policies have begun a good reform on some issues. He has made some good progress, not enough. And certainly antitrust is being changed. But in my opinion, antitrust, we need a new law. It's not only a question of practically using the existing laws, but we need the law to acknowledge that antitrust is a law that is designed to restrain market power, period. That's it. And under various interpretations, they are talking about antitrust being a law about consumer welfare, which is completely nonsensical. So there are many changes that can happen with the Biden administration or any other reform-minded administration that will come. But I have no illusion that it'll take a long time, because it took 35 years between 1905 and 1937 when the New Deal was formulated, partly because of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in Lochner decision of 1905 resisted change until 1937. 1937, the Supreme Court finally yielded on a minor minimum wage law from Washington State. But the Supreme Court is not about to change, and the Supreme Court will resist any serious attempt at reform today. And it'll take time until the Supreme Court will change. So I am very optimistic about America, but I think that we need patience as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I join you in that optimism. The pendulum does swing. And I did notice the reference to Teddy Roosevelt and as an accidental president. So things like that do happen. And that was an interesting turn of events. So Mordecai, I really want to thank you for joining us. And, I think your research is really important. I look forward to your next book. And folks, if you have not read The Market Power of Technology, Understanding the Second Gilded Age, I urge you to go out and read it. It is not just fascinating, it's also important. Mordecai, thanks for joining us here at UCLA on our Forecast Direct podcast.
It's my pleasure. I can only add the sentence that your listeners can also read those two articles in Project Syndicates that I have written in the last 3 months, which will help them understand the book as well. Thank you very much for giving me the chance to explain my theory.
Thank you for joining us.
Bye.